the 30th of January 1985, a conversation with Sir Anthony Parsons about Iran. Now, I ask the first question, if I may, which is, prior to going to Iran, like 20 or 30 years before, you chose to study Arabic and Turkish at the university. Why was that, and what made you interested in the Middle East, and then subsequently in Persia?
It goes back a very long way. I was in the Middle East in the army in the war. And after the war, I joined the Palestine government. And in 1948, when the Palestine mandate came to an end, I returned to England and went back to university because my education had been interrupted by the war. And I decided, because I knew Arabic from my service in the Palestine government, to read Islamic studies at Oxford. I chose Turkish as my second language, Arabic being my first language, really on the advice of my professor, because he said that Persian was much easier and I could learn it later on, and while I was at university I might still do the more difficult of the two languages. But of course it was a degree course in the whole Islamic civilization. So I studied Iranian history from Islamic times onwards up to the Middle Ages, effectively really up to the final collapse of the Abbasid Empire. So I had a lot of Islamic-Iranian background in my head when I went into the diplomatic service after leaving Oxford. Then in the early 1950s, I was in the embassy in Iraq, and I was there at the time of the Abadan crisis.
The oil crisis.
Exactly. The nationalization in the Mossadegh period.
That's right, 1951.
51 to 53, I was there. I was in the embassy in Baghdad when our embassy was thrown out of Iran, and I remember welcoming the departing diplomats from Tehran who came out by Land Rover for our Kermanshah and stayed in Baghdad for a time on the way through. I was also still in Baghdad when the Shah left the country for Rome and when he returned, and by a curious coincidence, which had actually genuinely nothing to do with Iranian affairs, I was actually meeting people at the airport on the same day when he passed through on both occasions. And so I saw him go out and I saw him come back. And I vividly remember how on the way out, when he was going to Rome, there was nobody there on behalf of the Iranian embassy to greet him or anything, and how on the way back the whole Iranian embassy staff was present at the airport. And I remember him walking down the steps of the airplane and they were all at the bottom, and he simply looked straight ahead and walked straight through without acknowledging their presence in any way. That was one of my first direct experiences of Iran. But of course in Iraq at that time, I mean, the politics of Iraq were very much affected by the oil nationalization crisis, by the Mossadegh period, and there was great interest in the country and amongst us in the embassy in what was happening in Iran. Well, after that, I then spent 4 years in the embassy in Turkey from 1955 to the beginning of 1959. By that time, of course, Iran, well, very shortly after I arrived in Turkey, Iran became a member of the Baghdad Pact. So I saw more of the Iranian embassy staff in Tehran than I did of most other embassy staffs, because we were co-partners in the Baghdad Pact. Then, of course, after the Iraqi Revolution, the Baghdad Pact headquarters moved to Ankara. So this connection between the British embassy and the Iranian embassy became even more intense.
What was the Baghdad? Was the Baghdad Pact a kind of precursor to center?
Indeed. I mean, what happened was that in 1955, the First of all, the Turks and the Iraqis signed a kind of mutual security pact between the two of them. No, I think that was in 1954. In 1955, the Anglo-Iraqi bilateral treaty, under which we were entitled to keep military bases in Iraq, ran out, or was about to run out. Clearly, in the political atmosphere at the time, to renew an old-fashioned bilateral treaty of that kind with an Arab state was out of the question. And so out of the Turco-Iraqi initiative arose this multilateral Baghdad Pact, which was first of all Turkey, Iraq, and Britain. The United States never joined as a full member, but they joined all the committees of the pact. It had a military committee, it had an economic committee, it had a counter-subversion committee, etc., etc., like all these pacts do. The Americans were members of everything, but not actually formally of the pact itself. A serious attempt was made to persuade other Arab states to join, Nasser's Egypt and Jordan in particular. Nasser's Egypt turned against the thing, as did Syria. Jordan...
Why?
Well, it became a polarizing influence, really. Nasser's Egypt was aiming for non-alignment, total independence of Western imperialism. And Nasser saw the Baghdad Pact really as a disguised means of perpetuating Western, particularly British, imperialism and sphere of influence in the Arab world. So, very quickly, the pact became a polarizing influence in the Arab world, and the Arab countries lined up, really, kind of Baghdad Pact supporters, pro-West, Baghdad Pact opponents, pro-non-alignment. We made an attempt to bring Jordan into the pact in 1955 or early 56, I forget which now, which led to violent riots in Amman, and King Hussein just couldn't politically have got away with joining. And the only two subsequent adherents to the pact were Iran in, I think, mid-1955, and Pakistan. Now, it only became center when, after the Iraqi revolution, Iraq obviously withdrew from the pact. The pact at the time had its headquarters in Baghdad. So the headquarters moved to Ankara. It could obviously no longer be called the Baghdad Pact, since Baghdad had pulled out of it and was violently hostile to it. I was still in Turkey, and so we had the terrible problem of finding a new name. And so eventually it was decided to call it the Central Treaty Organization. But it was, in effect, the old Baghdad Pact minus Iraq.
So that was Iran, Pakistan, Turkey,
Britain, and America in all except name.
That's right.
So this, because there were in Ankara at the time, I mean, there were ministerial meetings every year, there were committee meetings going on the whole time, and this created a very close relationship between the British and the Iranian embassies there. And it was at that time, in Ankara, that I got to know very well, first of all, your brother,
Nasir.
And secondly, Amir Abbas Hoveyda. We all became really very close friends. So really, through all that period, from my university days, through Baghdad, through Ankara, I had acquired really a pretty good working knowledge of Iran without actually having served in the country itself. Thereafter, I was political agent in Bahrain, in the Persian Gulf, from 1965 to 1969. And of course, this was at the time still when the British were in a protective relationship over Bahrain, and we were responsible for Bahrain's external defense and foreign affairs. So I was, in effect, the kind of mini-ambassador to the state of Bahrain, and at the same time, the Sheikh's foreign minister and defense minister, we'll put it like that. I need hardly say to you that the principal foreign policy problem of Bahrain was the fact that it was claimed as the 14th province of Iran. So this also gave me a considerable focus, as it were, in Iranian affairs. I mean, this was my main foreign policy preoccupation.
Before we move on, I would just to clarify, in case something nobody knows anything about you, is that the purpose, I mean, the Baghdad Pact was a British idea, was it?
The Baghdad Pact was, well, many people have different views. The principal concern of Turkey at the time was defense against the Soviet Union. Turkey was, of course, a member of NATO. Turkey was very anxious, for geographical reasons, to bring Iraq into the general pattern of what kind of northern tier defense against the Soviet Union, because after all, the Soviet move through Iraq would completely outflank Turkey. So the idea of a Turco-Iraqi security pact was, in effect, a Turkish initiative, really designed to secure themselves in relationship to the Soviet Union. Now, it happened at a time when we, the British, who needed bases in Iraq, mainly for communications to the Far East, not to India, because of course India was already independent, but we still had major possessions and responsibilities in the Far East. We were worried that when the Anglo-Iraqi Treaty ran out, which entitled us to have these two Royal Air Force bases in the country, one at Habaneer west of Baghdad, one at Shaiba in the south near Basra, that we would have no means, as it were, of maintaining our bases. So it was very convenient for us that this Turco-Iraqi agreement had taken place, which we felt we could build on in order to create a multilateral relationship which would enable us to retain our bases in the country, and also, since we are also members of NATO, help to reinforce this Turkish notion of building up what the Americans ultimately came to call the northern tier of Western defense against the Soviet Union. So it was a convenient diplomatic move, as it were, from everybody's point of view. But of course the unfortunate effect, and our intention originally, as he was, to bring in as many other Arab countries as we could, in to put the Arab countries more in a defense posture vis-a-vis the Soviet Union than simply quarreling amongst themselves and focusing on nothing but Israel. But we were unsuccessful with Nasser, we were unsuccessful with the Syrians, the French were never very keen on the Baghdad Pact, they too saw it rather as a perpetuation of British influence in the area. And it did become a polarizing element. You know, you were either, if you were pro-pact, you were a Western stooge. If you were anti-pact, you were a respectable nationalist, as it were. So that was really the kind of background for the pact.
So you, we can now move forward to where you were British agent, in other words, in effect, foreign minister of the Bahrain,
right,
as it were, which was claimed as the 14th province of Iraq. So what was the position of the British? Did they want Iran to have Bahrain or not?
No, I mean we had, we'd been in a protective relationship with Bahrain since 1820. And we had always resisted the Iranian claim. We took the view that Bahrain was an independent state and it was an independent Arab state, and we'd always taken that view. Through the 19th century, the dispute over the claim, which became an Anglo-Iranian dispute because we were looking after Bahrain's foreign policy, flared up and flared down, and I think it was in the 1850s it led to a breach in diplomatic relations, and it was always on the table between us. Negotiations went on and went off and went on again and went off again, right through, really, until the final days. And by 1968, when we had announced that we were going to withdraw from the Persian Gulf, withdraw our military presence in the Persian Gulf, terminate the protective treaties by 1971, it was really the principal stumbling block for the future stability of the Persian Gulf, because there appeared to be no possibility of a peaceful settlement. We all realized that if we removed our protection, terminated the treaties, and the claim was unsettled, that the Shah would have an extremely difficult choice. He would either have to make a unilateral climb down, which wouldn't have been very popular internally in Iran, or he would have to prosecute his claim by force,
which would invade Bahrain,
in effect, which would have meant, of course, a complete destruction of the whole stability of the Gulf, because it would have led to a conflict with Saudi Arabia, and it would have led to an absolutely irreparable breach, really, between Iran and the whole Arab world, and might even have drawn the great powers in if there had been military action of that kind. So, in my last year in Bahrain, this was a matter of enormous preoccupation on everybody's part. Well then, at the end of 1968, I think it was, the Shah performed an act of major statesmanship. As I remember, I can't remember the exact dates, I can't remember his exact words, but he was on a state visit in India.
That's in 68.
Yes, it was towards the end of 68, as I recall it. He was on a state visit to India, and he gave a press conference at the end of his state visit, and he included in his statement to the press conference a passage on Bahrain. And what he said was, in effect, that Bahrain always has been part of Iran, mm-hmm. and I have no doubt in my mind that it still is. But 200 years have passed since we were able to exercise our sovereignty, and it may very well be that the population has changed in the meantime, that the views of the people have changed. And if the views of the people are ascertained in an acceptable manner, acceptable to the international community as a whole, I am prepared to accept their views as regards the future, whatever they may be.
Wonderful.
Now, this was an act of enormous statesmanship. There's no question about that.
And also of humanity, I think.
And also of humanity.
In other words, people belong to who and where they want to
where they want. It was really a kind of classic support for the principle of self-determination. Now, this opened the door to a peaceful settlement. And up to that point, the Iranian claim had had a most damaging effect, both on the politics of Bahrain and on the economy of Bahrain. Politically, it was a source of continual neurosis. I remember on one occasion, this is quite a true story, I was driving somewhere near the airport in Bahrain, which is just alongside a big Arab town, Muharraq. And I suddenly found that there were hundreds and hundreds of people in the street all around my car, rushing towards the airport with sticks in their hands and carrying stones and all the rest of it. So I stopped one of these people in the street and said, "What's happening?" And he shouted out, "The Persians have landed, the Persians have landed, we're going to resist them." So I said, "What are you talking about?" And I looked up, and there I saw on the runway at the airport an aeroplane with a large lion on its very large tail fin. In fact, it was an aeroplane of British Caledonian Airways, which have the Scottish lion on the thing. The people of Muharraq had seen this from their homes and imagined it was the lion of Iran and had rushed to repel the invaders. I mean, this, I tell this story as an illustration, as it were, of the tension which the claim produced the whole time. Economically, you had a situation where no foreign firm which wanted to do business throughout the area, including Iran, was prepared to have its headquarters in the obvious center of communications and the most civilized place to live in on the Arab side of the Persian Gulf, namely Bahrain, because if you had your headquarters in Bahrain, you couldn't do any business with Persia. So it was both extremely damaging to the economy of the country and extremely damaging, really, to the stability of the country. Well, came back again, after the Shah's statement, the Iranian government and ourselves, on behalf of the Bahrainis, consulted the Secretary General of the United Nations. Now, by that time, by coincidence, I had been transferred from being political agent to being counselor in the United Kingdom delegation to the UN in New York. Just at the time when we were making our first approach to the Secretary General to follow up the Shah's initiative in Delhi. Well, having been 4 years in Bahrain, my boss, the ambassador, delegated the actual negotiating to me, naturally enough. So for a year or so, until May or June 1970, I was negotiating with the Secretary General's number two, Ralph Bunche, who is the person responsible for peace and security problems, with the Iranian permanent representative in New York, Mehdi Vakil, in order to work out a formula which everybody could agree, under which the United Nations Secretary General could send a team to the island to actually find out what the wishes of the people were. Well, it was a difficult negotiation, but by the beginning of 1970, we've got agreement, and a senior official of the UN, an Italian Under-Secretary General, went with a small team to Bahrain, and he consulted all the kind of clubs and institutions and organizations and trade unions and everybody he could find, get hold of. He came back and reported in full to the Secretary General. And of course, 99% or 90-something percent of the population had said that they wanted to be an independent Arab state. The Secretary General submitted this report to the Security Council, and a Security Council resolution was debated. Iran was present. A Bahraini delegation was sitting in the background. We were up front, as it were, representing Bahrain. The resolution was adopted unanimously, and that was the peaceful settlement of this 200-year-old claim.
That's wonderful.
It's one of the classic textbook successes of the United Nations. A peaceful settlement of a really very deep-rooted and very intractable dispute. And
really, it's thanks to the wisdom of the Shah.
Exactly. Right? I mean, I emphasize this point, that it started entirely by the Shah's move that he made in Delhi, by this statesmanlike move he made there. Because by that time, I personally, I mean, as political agent, as advisor on foreign affairs to the Sheikh of Bahrain, I mean, I'd reached a point of despair when I thought the only thing to do was for Bahrain simply to apply for UN membership, hope that it would get the votes, that Iran would not be able to collect the necessary vetoes and votes to stop them, get in somehow, and simply face it out like that and hope that Iran would be deterred simply because Bahrain was a member. Well, now that would obviously have been an extremely unsatisfactory way to do it, but I simply couldn't see an alternative at the time. And I must say, I mean, it gives me pleasure to say, after all these tragedies that have happened, that the Shah opened the door.
It's wonderful. I wish they had done the same for Islam. The same spirit of understanding prevailed, let us say, over the Falklands.
Well, I entirely agree. I entirely agree. I mean, not dissimilar case. But in the Bahrain case, it all worked, you know. It was a classic UN operation, and it, you know, people don't know much about it. In fact, I was lecturing last night on the United Nations to a group of about 200 overseas graduates of London University, and I brought this one out. I told the story in illustration, as it were, of how the UN can play an extremely valuable part, provided the parties themselves are prepared to behave sensibly in settling very difficult disputes. Because after all, this dispute had been going on since 1785.
Yes. But of course, as you say, UN can only act if the people involved are civilized enough to agree with such principles as self-determination.
Exactly. And the real point of the thing was that the Shah worked out in his own mind that either of the two choices, with the claim unsettled, were really unacceptable. The two choices lying ahead of Iran. And that the only valid thing for him to do, in terms of his own public opinion, was to put the things in the hand, the thing in the hands of the international community, so that he could accept the will, as it were, of the international community as a member in good standing of that community, which of course defused in a way the internal political problem of giving up the claim. And it was an act of great statesmanship, there's no doubt about it.
Yes. So let us carry on from there then. So that was the beginning of your involvement.
That in a sense, yes, that intensified my involvement. And of course, I was very much personally involved in the thing right up to May or June, whenever it was in 1970, when the Security Council finally laid the claim to rest. Well, then at the end of 1970, I was transferred back to the Foreign Office. And I was Assistant Under Secretary responsible for our relations with all the Middle East, amongst other areas of the world, for the next 3 years. Well, Iran came within my area of responsibility. And of course, by that time, Iran had become, I suppose, one of the, say, 15 or 20 most important countries in the world to Britain in terms of British interests.
And what were those interests?
Well, to start with, of course, we were still formally allies in CENTO. I mean, CENTO may not have been a very effective pact, but we were military allies.
Which involved that if, for the sake of argument, the Russians invaded Persia, you would have to go to them.
Yes, we'd have had to have done something about it. And then if there'd been any regional problem really involving Iran directly, Iran could have called on CENTO as a body to do something about it. So we were allies in CENTO. We were very conscious indeed of Iran's general geopolitical importance in the strategic sense because of her geographical position. We were at that time, I suppose in the early 70s, right through the 70s, before the North Sea was fully exploited, we were getting, I would say, between 12% and 20% of our total oil supplies in this country from Iran, which is an awful lot. In the early mid-70s, in commercial terms, Iran was buying, in military terms, I think something like 30%, 35% of Britain's total global military exports, which is not a very well-known fact. It's a great deal. And by that I mean military exports including to the United States, to other European countries, I mean the whole world. So Iran is buying 35% of our total defense sales overseas. Iran, in civilian terms, civil terms, was our, I think, 12th largest export market in the world. I mean, after Western Europe, the United States, Canada, I think Iran was actually our largest export market. I mean, by 1978, we were exporting about £1,000 million a year of civilian goods to Iran, whereas, to take a comparison, I suppose, to, well, one figure that sticks in my mind at the time, our exports to Libya, for example, were something like £40 million a year.
So it was
very
big.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was very, very big stuff indeed. So Iran. Also, of course, there was an additional factor in this, that a lot of our business with Iran was extremely important from the point of view of employment in Britain. For example, the Paycon car, which at the time was Chrysler United Kingdom, and is now Talbot United Kingdom. In my day, the Paycon contract represented 51% of the total operation of Chrysler UK. So if the Paycon contract had collapsed, Chrysler UK would have collapsed because it couldn't have carried on with only 50% of its operation. This meant that, together with the people who were directly employed and the suppliers, outside suppliers to Chrysler UK, the Paycon contract was probably directly responsible for the employment of, say, 40,000 workers in Britain. Well, now, if you add that to the Leyland contract for trucks and so on, the military contracts, a number of other things. I mean, there were hundreds of firms. There were certain small firms by 1976-77 of whom 80% of their total product, both domestic and for export, was going to Iran. So I suppose that Iran was directly or indirectly responsible in one way or another for the actual employment in Britain of, I don't know, between, say, 100,000 and half a million people, a lot of people. So it was a very, very important country indeed. And so in the early 70s, when I was the Under-Secretary, I had a great deal to do with Iran. To start with, of course, this was in the closing days of our ending about